As counselor to the president, Karen Hughes was responsible for managing the president's message and overseeing all his communications efforts. Her chief role was to help instill and enforce message discipline throughout the White House and the administration as a whole. She also served as an advisor on most important decisions made at the senior staff level and by the president. Thus, politics and policy were deeply interwoven within the fabric of the Bush White House. Most of us who had been around politics for any length of time found this completely natural and far from sinister. We considered the president more open, forthright, and honest than his predecessor, and we viewed him as right on the issues, as well as closely in sync with the views of most Americans. As far as we could see, there was no contradiction between these assumptions and the existence of a large political operation within the White House dedicated to setting the public agenda. It was just part of the political process, a job that needed to be done and that we were happy and honored to perform. But stepping outside the White House bubble and looking back from today's perspective, it's easier to see that much of what we were doing was no different from the things our immediate predecessor had done. Like the Clinton administration, we had an elaborate campaign structure within the White House that drove much of what we did. We were always focused on how to control the agenda, shape the media narrative, and build public support for our policies, the same things Democratic leaders in Washington sought to do. Bush had promised to change the way things were done in Washington, but how could he change the game if his administration continued to play by the very same rules? At the time, I didn't recognize the contradiction, and neither, I think, did most of my colleagues. However, the system worked, at least in those early months. It helped us pass the president's tax cuts by late May. We had argued that a large portion of the projected $5.6 trillion budget surplus, which included $2.6 trillion designated for Social Security, ought to be returned to taxpayers. This would help stimulate growth and job creation and bring the economy out of its downturn, determined by later economic reports to be a recession. Bush visited 26 states during his first 100 days in office, and many of these trips were focused on getting the public to pressure Congress to act. There was plenty of skepticism in the media coverage, and at first, not a lot of support in the polls. But the campaign effort proved remarkably successful. The package as passed was not everything Bush had wanted, but he largely got what he sought, a $1.35 trillion tax cut over 10 years, just below the $1.6 trillion he'd advocated. Bush received some bipartisan support, including garnering yes votes from 12 Democrats in the Senate. The president's No Child Left Behind, NCLB, education bill was another beneficiary of the administration's campaign posture, aimed at closing the achievement gap between high-performing and low-ranked school districts. NCLB also made it through both the House and Senate on the heels of a carefully orchestrated public outreach effort. After differences in numerous details, including some extended partisan wrangling over funding levels, particularly in the soon-to-be Democratic-controlled Senate, were worked out and agreed to by conference committee members, the bill would be signed into law in January 2002. There were plenty of bumps in the road in those early months. Senator Jim Jeffords of Vermont, a lifelong moderate Republican, decided to bolt the party just as the tax cut legislation was set to pass in late May. He became an independent and caucused with the Democrats, giving them effective control of the Senate and making Tom Daschle of South Dakota the majority leader. Our 60-day regulatory review of Clinton-era regulations, which had yet to go into effect, caused some public perception problems. When certain rules were rolled back or weakened, some critics used the decisions to paint Bush as being anti-environment or more concerned about corporate interest than with protecting individual Americans. The president's Energy Task Force, chaired by Vice President Cheney, held a series of meetings with outside interest whose identities were withheld from the public. This created an early impression of an administration prone to secrecy and reinforced the image of the Bush White House as enthrall to corporate interest. As with any new administration, there were some glitches that caused us to change our procedures. For example, there were a few leaks to the media concerning White House message strategy discussions, something that Bush intensely disliked, as did Card, Rove, and Hughes. To prevent future leaks, some strategy planning meetings were reconfigured. The twice-weekly message meeting turned into more of a general run-through of the public schedule and what the topics would be than an open discussion and deliberation about ideas. those strategic decisions were left to much smaller meetings of top advisors. As summer arrived, we seemed to be having some trouble defining a clear, big-picture message to cut through the news clutter. We were struggling to get high-priority legislation like the Patients' Bill of Rights and the Faith-Based Initiative passed. Criticism of the White House communications and legislative operations began to surface. There was plenty of discussion internally about how to come up with new ways to highlight our top priorities so that the media would follow our lead, and we would not fall into the trap of engaging in small-ball issues and reacting to the agenda of others. As for me, I was settling into my new life, getting fully acclimated to the internal White House operations, traveling with the president, and dealing with the national media. In April, I had to face a lively press corps covering the first foreign policy crisis for the Bush White House, the heroic emergency landing on Chinese territory of a U.S. surveillance plane, an EP-3 Ares, after a mid-air collision with a Chinese fighter jet sent to intercept it. The Chinese fighter pilot crashed to his death. Our American service members were in Chinese custody at the time. Over the course of several days, the president and his national security team managed to bring the crisis to a successful conclusion without escalating the situation, including the safe return of our military men and women. I also had to handle the live briefing on the morning of the president's controversial decision on stem cell research, which was announced in his first primetime address as president from Crawford in early August. Moments like these constituted my baptism by fire as a presidential spokesman and gave me some early confidence that I could handle future challenges if necessary. Bush's early presidency was mainly focused on the domestic agenda, but the president did start to define himself on the foreign policy front. He was pushing ahead on missile defense, which would ultimately lead to the U.S. withdrawal from the ABM treaty with Russia. Military transformation was a top priority for Bush, and his Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, began pushing ahead on it. The president gave his first major foreign policy address in Europe during a stop in Warsaw when he urged the spread of freedom across the world. He also focused heavily on personal diplomacy, establishing close personal relationships with world leaders to strengthen our alliances. And Bush and his national security team made clear that we were determined to pursue a tougher approach for dealing with Saddam Hussein and his rogue Iraqi regime, though no one at the time was predicting an imminent crisis in the region. Still, Bush and his advisors were sending clear signals that more robust military action, rather than a tit-for-tat response, was likely if the regime stepped out of line. As concern grew within the administration that the sanctions of the previous decade were continuing to weaken, Russia prevented the new smart sanctions approach toward Iraq proposed by the United States from getting through the Security Council in the summer of 2001. The first 7 months of the Bush administration were not devoid of political push and pull. I could certainly tell that Washington was not Texas. Trust was lacking between leaders of the two parties in Congress. Memories of past affronts were long, and distrust ran deep. Bitterness over the contested 2000 election results still lingered among some Democrats. Suspicion over whether the president was sincere about wanting to be a uniter, not a divider, was commonplace, and some liberals doubted that the phrase compassionate conservative could ever be more than a meaningless paradox. But we in the Bush administration had enjoyed enough bipartisan success with our tax cuts and No Child Left Behind that we were still optimistic about the possibility of unifying the nation behind an agenda that most Americans, if not all, could be proud to embrace. And then came the day that changed everything.